The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. The intro is a little bit off. Jim is not joining us today. Not that there's anything wrong. He's doing well. He just had a scheduling conflict today. So that gives me the opportunity, actually, to invite Greg back. So Greg's going to join me this morning. When I'm recording this, I don't know when you're listening to it, but it is 10 a.m. where I'm at as I'm recording this. It's noon back where Greg is with the fabulous internet. We can produce this podcast with people from all over the country. So we've got Greg, and he's got his latest upgraded electronics. So Greg, welcome to the show. How does it sound?
Hi, Chris. I think it sounds better.
I think it sounds better too.
So
I think our listeners will be pleased now that we've got the technical glitches worked out. Should be able to hear Greg a lot better when he's periodically on the show. Since we did have a slew of LTC, long-term care-based questions come in, since Jim was not available, this was a prime opportunity for us to knock a few of those LTC questions out related to, you know, several of the shows that we've done lately. The very last EDU show was not long-term care-related. And we're going to be doing some other shows here, so we're not going to be, LTC all the time every week. But since we have this backlog of questions, I thought it was a good idea to kind of spend one more Q&A show focused on long-term care. So, Greg, we have a handful of questions here that have come in, and let me pull up the first one here. So these questions, kind of all over the board, but all related to LTC. The first one here is from a listener in beautiful wine country, Temecula, California. So George, as we always refer to them, is writing to us from beautiful state of California. And beautiful when it's not burning. Same can be said for Colorado. But their question is about inflation. So I'm not going to share. They gave us kind of a story about some experiences with his wife's grandmother. But the key question here is, what is the average rate of inflation for nursing care and or assisted living? Medical care has inflation rates over 3% every year. Does the same apply to nursing and assisted living? If so, since average cost is now $100,000 for a nursing home, being 50, am I looking at over $200,000 a year in 30 years when I'm 80? How do I plan for that $200,000 cost with LTC insurance for that scenario? So what, by the way, with our medical expenses that are part of the minimum dignity floor that we always include with our retirement planning process, if you pay attention to how we do things, medical is a big chunk of that minimum dignity floor, usually the single largest individual category in that minimum dignity floor. And we, in our projections, inflate things based on information that we've gathered from the past couple of decades as far as medical costs increasing. I always tell people that I'm hoping, or we're hoping, that that kind of tapers off that growth rate, but we're not crossing our fingers and hoping it happens and putting that into the projections. We're projecting based on the reality of the last couple of decades. And a lot of medical expenses are going up in the 4.5 to 6.5% category. So that's what he's referring to when he talks about medical going up over 3%. I personally don't think those high rates are sustainable long term, but I'm not sure what the solution is going to be. So that's a topic for another show. But as far as LTC goes, Greg, what kind of upward pressures or inflationary pressures are we seeing on the nursing home / assisted living category?
Well, so for nursing home, we have recent data from this past December from a survey that's done nationally, looking at each state and looking at the different types of care and care settings. But specifically for nursing home care, the over the last 5 years, the average growth rate is about 3% nationally. In California, it's been about 5.7%, looks like. Whereas in Wisconsin, for example, 2.6. So the thing to understand about the growth and cost of care is it varies not only by the type of care and the setting, but also varies sometimes widely from state to state across the country. But since this listener's in California, I wanted to, you know, speak to the data from California. So again, almost 6% over the last 5 years for nursing home care in California. This just recent, most recent year, it was 3.5% growth rate. In assisted living, the national average over the last 5 years is about 3.5%. And just in the past year has been about 6%. And that goes for California as well, 6%. So there are certainly changing pressures in our country, and particularly with COVID. The usage of long-term care facilities is dropping, and the demand for home care is increasing. And that trend, in my view, will probably continue. So, you know, there are a number of factors that cause that that rate to rise, you know, around supply and demand of the services, but as well as a shortage of workers, for example, for home care, and a number of other factors that drive up the cost. So the bottom line is, when we're working with clients, we look at the cost of care for their area, and we look at these growth rates to help us understand what a reasonable, you know, growth rate would be to project into the future. And then as we're looking at long-term care policies, we usually add an inflation benefit on the policy. So that addresses the concern this listener mentioned about, you know, what do I do 20, 30 years from now? How am I going to pay for it? The idea is that we put an inflation benefit on the policy so that that benefit at least attempts to keep up with the growth and cost of care. It may not, you know, it may, there may be a shortfall, or it may lag depending, but we really can't predict predict the future, obviously.
Well, and I'll point out that these inflationary pressures need to be considered whether you're interested in long-term care insurance or not. This isn't just an insurance question. This is a, how am I going to prepare for funding these potential expenses using my own dollars, what we call self-funding, or with insurance, or a combination of the two, which is a very popular approach, some blended approach. They need to be considered. And for those of you self-funding, this is a key assumption that needs to be in your projections when you're trying to determine how much you need to set aside of your assets for the potentiality of these expenses occurring. You've got to build in this inflationary assumption here, which affects how much you're going to have to set aside. Now, one thing I'm curious about, because I honestly don't know the specifics of this, and that's why I'm happy I've got Greg on the inflation adjustments on the long-term care policies, do they have policies that adjust kind of dynamically to something like CPI or a measure of actual care inflation, or do we have to pick a number?
There is one policy or one carrier out there that does offer the option of tying the inflation benefit to the CPI for healthcare. I only know of one carrier that does that. Otherwise, you just pick, you know, you pick an option, and some of the policies will allow you to increase that. They call it a buy-up option if you want to add inflation later. And there's at least one carrier that offers that option. So I only know of one, Chris, that ties it to that type of an index.
Mm-hmm. So what are the...
To your other point, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, to your other point about self-funding versus insurance, the challenge there is you want to get some growth. You know, if you're doing a self-funding, a set aside, you know, you want to balance that protection, that principal protection, with at least some growth, because, you know, in most cases, the care is going to be needed later, much mm-hmm. later.
So on the policies where you have to pick a number, what range of inflationary, you know, adjustments to the benefits are you able to choose? Do they allow you to go over 3? So if you want to prepare for something like this, you know, California for the past 5 years being at 5.7, can you pick a 5 or 6% inflation adjustment on the benefit?
5%'s the top end. Okay. So most of the policies, there's a range, you know, it varies certainly by the insurance companies offering as to what specific rates they offer. But generally speaking, it's anywhere from 1 to 5%. Many of them offer compound and in some cases simple interest. So it varies.
Okay. That seems, that last comment, just to interpret for people, it's seems overly complicated for as a marketing tool to offer those two, because when you have inflation in the real world operates on a compound basis. So if you're trying to add an adjustment that keeps up with real world inflation, you want the compounding effect. Simple is just a way of looking at a bigger number that has the effect of giving a smaller increase. Because you don't get that compounding from year to year in the rate. So I'm personally annoyed having heard this by the companies that are offering a simple rate here, because of the whole intent of having the adjustment is to handle something that is going to affect you on a compound basis. You're going to buy a cure that doesn't have that effect, which is bizarre to me, but maybe I'm missing something. But I think it's just a marketing issue, which bothers me. But anyway, on that tangent. So the simple answer, or the somewhat simple answer to this person's question, is that you can build it into your forecasting for self-funding, or if you're going to buy long-term care insurance, it probably is wise to build in this inflationary number, you know, to your liking. The bigger the number, the more expensive the policy is going to be. That's just how things work. And if you want protection from high rates of inflation, you're going to have to pick something up towards the higher end of that, you know, 3, 4, 5 category for the inflation on the benefits. But that's how you kind of build in this protection for what he's indicating is, you know, maybe doubling the cost during, easily doubling the cost over his expected lifetime here. And that's how you'd handle that. So anything else you want to say on this particular question?
I don't think so. Thanks, Chris.
Okay. So the next question we've got is, where does this come from? Looks like another question from California. Not from beautiful wine country, but another different beautiful area. A little more smog in this area from L.A. The question goes on here. I listened to the podcast last night about Jim Stroke. First off, I'd like to say how glad I am that you made it, Jim. We are all too. The whole ordeal was riveting. Really hit home, and I was thinking about my own plans. I had the same plan in mind as you, he's referring to Jim, and was going to look into long-term care insurance when I got closer to retirement, 58 to 60. So that's, we've, you know, Jim has talked ad nauseum about how that is conventional wisdom in financial planning. There are exceptions. I'm sure there's somebody out there that's been pitching long-term care insurance, standard age to acquire much younger than 60. I'm sure you're out there. But conventional wisdom has been to kind of look at that age 60 as the magic age of you're not too old, so you hopefully can still qualify, but you're not so young that you're going to pay premiums for an excessively long period of time. So kind of that balancing act on acquiring insurance. So he was kind of buying into that same thing. He was thinking about looking into LTC insurance between 58 and 60 when he retired. He goes on, after hearing your story last night, I decided I needed to look into LTC insurance sooner than later, but I don't know where to start. Is there some advice you could provide as to how I could get started in searching for LTC insurance? So this is a product. Insurance is sold by professionals, by agents. It's not something you can just go buy off the shelf. It's a regulated industry, regulated by the states. So it isn't something you can just, you know, go to your local big box store, walk up and down the aisle and compare the long-term care policies. But Greg, do you have a resource or an idea where a person could start to learn more about what's available in their area? Because, you know, these aren't national policies. They're going to be state specific. There's a bit of overlap, but he'd want to be looking at things that are available to him in his particular state, in this particular case, California, again.
Right. So a couple things I would suggest. There's a National Association of Insurance Commissioners. So each state regulates insurance and they have an insurance commissioner. Mm-hmm. And this body publishes every year a shopper's guide to long-term care insurance. And we share that with our clients. It's a very informative document about long-term care and about the types of policies and the features of the policies and a worksheet of all of the things to consider when looking at a policy. These policies have a lot of features, and every company does their own sort of flavor of a policy. And so it makes it hard to compare them. You know, apples to apples comparison can be difficult, and the pricing really can vary quite a bit. But if you look at that shopper's guide, one thing they have in there is that I think at the back of it, there are some additional resources. And one thing you could do is go to your state's Department of Insurance. They all have websites, and that's maybe a good starting point to find out how to find licensed agents in your area. Beyond that, I would really encourage people to work with somebody who, first of all, they understand the insurance, but more importantly, they can show you quotes and policies from multiple insurance carriers. You know, there are agents who are captive, as we call it, to one particular insurance company. And they can be, you know, very good agents and give you good advice, but they may be limited to, you know, their company's policy or, you know, in some cases, maybe a few others. Likewise, your investment advisor may only be authorized to show you certain products that their firm decides are, you know, compliant or legitimate with what they want to offer their clients. So the point is that it's a good idea to find somebody who can play the field, if you will, and find the best fit for your situation and help you evaluate the various features on these policies and help you understand the trade-offs, because you're going to make trade-offs in one way or another, depending on what's important to you. For example, a couple might find that what's called a shared care benefit might be a high priority or a very important feature to have. So that might be a criterion for evaluating a particular policy. But again, the key thing is to find somebody who knows the landscape of long-term care and understands the policies and can show you multiple policies and help you evaluate those.
Mm-hmm. That shopper's guide I pulled up just so people know how to find it. If the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, or usually referred to as the NAIC, if you just Google LTC guide, it'll pop up real quickly, or you can Google, or you can search specifically for it. It's called A Shopper's Guide to Long-Term Care Insurance by the NAIC. 76 pages, so it's got a lot of information in it. It's just a PDF, so you can access it quite easily. You don't have to navigate through a big website or anything. The PDF will show up right in the search results, and I think that's a great place to start educating yourself on what it is, what types of things it does cover, and the different features, so you can at least understand what the person hopefully you're going to go to that's going to represent the policies as an agent will be using certain words. You'll understand how some of this stuff works prior to that conversation. I think that is a good idea, and that's a great resource. I had honestly forgotten that document existed.
Yeah, I think it's a great place to start, and it does give you a good context for meeting with an agent, it gives you that common language, at least a common starting point, so you're not going in completely blind, because it's a big decision and a big purchase if you do decide to purchase insurance.
Mm-hmm. One thing also
I would just add that we work with clients who, not always who we've done planning for, but I would encourage people to, to have a good handle on what your retirement plan looks like in terms of your cash flow and your assets and how that picture looks for you, because it's income that pays for long-term care. And so, one of the most important parts of a policy is how much is that cash flow going to be on a regular basis, whatever period of time you want that to be coming in. So it's important to work with, preferably to work with somebody who knows your situation, or at least asks you the right questions and understands your bigger picture going into it.
The other thing I'll point out related to this, because you said it's a big decision. I agree, it's a big decision to do it or not to do it, and then the impact of the cost of the insurance on the rest of your plan. I've had a number of cases where people were worried that it was going to be turn out that they couldn't, quote, afford it, or they wouldn't want to make it, but they didn't have their retirement plan done yet and they weren't sure how things are going to work, so they were holding off getting the insurance. I want to remind people. And I'm not saying this, we're not pushing insurance here. We're just responding to all these questions that have come up. This is a very personal decision. I'm not a cheerleader or a detractor of long-term care insurance. It's just one of those other things you have to decide on as you age, if you want to participate in this approach or not. But remember, insurance isn't an irrevocable situation. If you change your mind, you just stop. You cancel the policy. So I'm pointing this out because what I don't want people to do, say they're 55 or so, and they're not ready to do a retirement plan yet, and they're honestly not sure it's going to fit within their overall plan, or maybe they could afford it, but it's going to mean not nearly as much fun as they wanted, and they just decide they're not willing to make that trade-off, so they don't want it. Just because you buy LTC insurance at 55, you're not locked into it for the rest of your life. This isn't a lifetime promise of paying a premium. Insurance is a one-sided contract, meaning you have no obligation to continue paying the premiums. Now, you have to pay the premiums in order to have the policy in force, but you can stop at any time. So this has just come up enough times I felt like I needed to mention it. For those people who are out there delaying it, saying, well, once we do our retirement plan, when we get a little closer to retirement, then we'll figure out if it'll fit in the scenario. Then you're running this risk of you're going to get to the point where something will happen and you're not insurable. So it might be worth considering, even before you know for sure if it'll fit into your overall plan, if, again, if it's something you want to have as a choice. You don't want to put yourself in a position where the choice to have it or not is taken away from you. For when, you know, if that happens, it makes the choice easy. You don't have one, right? If you become uninsurable, that's no longer an option in your plan. So just planting that little seed. If you're of the age where you're starting to worry about being insurable moving forward, maybe get one. Maybe, you know, if you want to have that as a choice, and then as things move forward, you can then change your mind if you deem it appropriate in your circumstances. So just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
Okay. So the next question, let's see here. Where are they from? Pennsylvania. So no longer California. Beautiful state of Pennsylvania, which they point out has excellent hunting, fishing, and hiking opportunities. So they're just saying when Jim goes to Kentucky to visit for the first time, we're still waiting for him to make that first trip to Kentucky before he decides that that is, in fact, his retirement destination. And we've had this pointed out from a few people. Maybe visit the areas around there, too. Here they're pitching Pennsylvania as a consideration. But the LTC question is this. My wife and I are 68 and 67, respectively, and we are now reconsidering our previous LTC self-funding strategy. We're seriously considering purchasing an LTC insurance product to augment our self-funding strategy, but remain concerned regarding the selection of an LTC product. Considering the dreadful history of these products and the opacity of LTC insurance contracts, how can one find and evaluate products that will meet our needs and that will not disappoint in the future? Although somewhat skeptical, we remain open-minded and will consider both traditional LTC and hybrid life insurance / LTC rider products. We're also able to pay upfront lump sum payments should a hybrid product be the better choice. So let me focus in on this one comment that was in here. Considering the dreadful history of these products. You know, LTC doesn't have the most stellar reputation with people because of how it kind of started in on a bumpy road. There was a lot of LTC offered in the early days of LTC from a lot of different insurance companies. And a lot of times it was, especially from the perspective of today, quite affordable. Well, it turns out that the actuaries at the insurance companies had very much misforecasted the cost of care, the obligation the insurance companies were signing up for when they were promising to pay these benefits of these policies. Turns out that they were collecting not nearly enough in premiums to support the benefit promises that they were making, and things got really ugly. A couple things happened. Premiums started to go through the roof, had huge, and people get notifications of huge increases in their premiums. Remember, the initial cause was they mispriced them in the first place. So now they've got to ratchet them up. Other insurance companies decided we don't want to have anything to do with this. They just got out of the LTC business completely. And some insurance companies, it was so burdensome on them that they started to have financial difficulties. So this is what they're talking about, the dreadful history of these products. So, Greg, what can you share on how is 2021 different than 1991 on these LTC policies?
Well, first of all, the long-term care market, it's relatively young in the bigger world of insurance, mm-hmm. going back to maybe mid-70s, I think. And so a lot of the early policies that were written in the 80s and even the 90s and some beyond, as Chris indicated, they were not priced terribly accurately. And there were a few reasons for this. First of all, they didn't have a whole lot of data on which to base the pricing because it was a new part of the insurance industry. They also had, over time, as the government passed various laws and regulations, they made incremental improvements to how they wrote these contracts. So they became, over time, more standardized in terms of how you qualify and various provisions in these contracts. So from the standpoint of the evolution of the contracts, that's gotten a lot better and a lot more standardized. In terms of the rates, a lot of these policies in the early days came out when fixed interest rates were high, much higher than today. And so they were richer in terms of the, for example, the inflation benefits they would put on these policies. Some of them, many of them had 5% compounding on the benefit. And over time, and particularly in the 2000s, after 2009, 2010, the rates, the assumption about the interest rates the insurance company would get on the premium reserves were wildly high, way too high. And so that was one factor that caused the increases to be necessary. There were a couple of other factors. They made assumptions about what percentage of policyholders would surrender their policies. They based that on life insurance lapse rates, for example. And what they found was that most people don't surrender these policies once they have them. The other interesting thing, back to the data or lack of data in the early days, today they have, I think it's 70 times more claims data than they had 20 years ago. It's a much broader set of data on which they can base their pricing. They've also now understand that women typically live longer, which we know from statistics. And they also use long-term care more. They go on claim longer typically than men. So they built that assumption into their pricing as well. So what it amounts to, Chris, is that today's policies are priced far more accurately and more conservatively because over these decades, as things have played out and they have better data on claims and also better data on where long-term care is happening, they're able to price them more accurately. Regarding the rate increases that you mentioned, it's worth mentioning a few points there. There are a number of factors that are mitigating now that likelihood or probability of having a rate increase on a new policy today. The states have adopted what are called model regulations for the insurance industry around long-term care policies. And there are a number of requirements that they've placed on these insurance companies selling long-term care in each state. It makes it a lot harder for them to increase rates. They're not allowed to build profit in, there's a cap around that. And so they've basically removed the profit motive from increasing rates. They've included a requirement that they have to have a cushion in their pricing. So for a margin of error, and the actuaries have to certify that, that they're not anticipating an increase over the life of a policy. So bottom line is the risk is still there that if you buy a traditional policy today, that your premium could go up. The last study I saw, actuarial study, indicated about a 10% probability of a rate increase in the life of a policy that you buy today. So it's more in line with other types of insurance mm-hmm. that have increases. you know, it's not as wildly, you know, 50% increase every year. You know, you're not going to see that on new policies. They're far more stable, to the point where we feel it's a reasonable risk. You know, it's not, shouldn't be the deciding factor on its own, because there are many other valuable benefits on these traditional policies that you have to consider when you're, you know, when you're weighing the history.
So the landscape since the more troubled days of LTC has changed for, you know, there's pros and cons. Back in the day, I would say that generally the premiums were less expensive given the benefits compared to now. That was part of the problem that we just discussed, right? They were essentially underpriced.
That's
given
right.
what they were promising. So they are more expensive now, but at least it's a more stable, predictable number, which is most of the battle with planning, right? We're planning for the future here. I don't care what the number is. If we can rely on the number, it makes it much, much easier to plan around than the unknown or this, you know, potential tremendous volatility. So it's comforting to know that they've got a lot of these things worked out, and there's a lot more stability in the premiums and a lot more stability in who's offering them. Some of this tightening of the regulations and things is why I would say one of the downsides is there's not as many companies to choose from, which actually I guess that could be an upside, right? Sometimes there can be just too darn many choices, makes it difficult to wade through it all. But there's certainly far fewer choices now, partly because of these regulatory constraints. But I think it's, you know, the net effect is stabilization here. So I wouldn't focus too much on what they call the dreadful history of these products. This has been addressed both by the insurance companies themselves, and regulators have forced addressing of these, and the whole system, I believe, has been improved. They do mention also the upfront, you know, lump sum version, you know, of premiums, or the fixed pay, what we would refer to as a 5-pay or a 10-pay, where you pay premiums for a fixed period of time, and after you're done paying the premium, the chance of a premium increase is, guess what, zero, right? Because you're no longer paying premiums. So if you are really worried about this, that might be one of the things to look at. But what kind of policies have that choice to pay not premiums as long as you have the policy, but rather either a lump sum amount or a fixed period where you're paying premiums? What types of policies are those?
So generally, it's the hybrid policies that that offer either a single premium. There are maybe one or two exceptions in the traditional side, but let's just focus on hybrid. The hybrid policies are typically a single premium. However, Chris, as you mentioned, they do offer many of the carriers the ability to pay a level premium. So it's still guaranteed, but it's spread out over 5 years or maybe 10 years or maybe 15 years. Mm-hmm. And for some situations, some clients want to do that. There may be a good reason to do it that way. But in either case, you know, your premium is guaranteed either way, whether it's obviously if it's a single premium, you're one and done. But mm-hmm. If it's a spread out payment, those are also still guaranteed.
Got it. Okay. Anything else you want to say before I give you the next one?
No, I think that's it.
Okay. So this one, let's see here. They don't say where this comes in, but a pretty short and sweet question. I've heard about return of premium LTC policies. How do they work, and what choices or what types of policies have this, quote, feature? So, like I said, short and sweet. What is the return of premium feature, and what types of policies have that as a choice on there, and why might someone want that feature?
Well, so it's likely that when most people hear about return of premium, they're referring to a hybrid policy again. However, it's important to understand that the traditional policies all offer some degree of return of premium, but very limited, and, you know, under certain conditions. So I don't want to go down that road, because I think what this writer is asking about relates to hybrid policies. So the hybrid policies have the advantage of overcoming the perception that if you don't use the insurance, you've just paid all these premiums and got nothing out of the policy.
Which is a classic complaint historically of LTC policies, is people are thinking, I'm gonna sink all this into insurance. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to need it. I'm going to live, and then I'm going to pass away peacefully in my own bed, never needing it. And now I've paid all this, and I've robbed my children of an inheritance. That's their argument for not getting it, which, you know, there's all kinds of discussions we could have about if that's an appropriate way to look right at insurance or not. But nevertheless, no matter what the logic is behind it, that is a very common concern or barrier that people put up when considering LTC policies in general. So this is a feature that is designed to overcome that objection. So just to clarify why people would be interested, that's what has classically been heard when LTC is brought up with people, not just from us personally. This is an industry-wide issue. That's why the insurance companies have created this feature. So just wanted to add that. So go ahead with what you were going to say.
Right. So the hybrid policy is, as its name indicates, it has two parts. And I'll just speak to the most common one, which is part life insurance and part LTC insurance. And it's, so what it is a policy that's built upon a life insurance policy as its base. And then it has a rider attached to it that continues to pay long-term care benefits once the death benefit is exhausted. So let me explain that. I'll just take a hypothetical $100,000 premium for this type of policy. If you pay $100,000 to the insurance company, you're going to buy a life insurance policy, a death benefit of $100,000. Usually it's a little bit more than that starting out. So your policy will have a death benefit, and then it will have a rider, as it's called, an additional part to the policy that will continue to pay LTC benefits if you need those. So what happens is if you go on claim, the benefits that you draw from the policy come first out of that death benefit. And it's usually over a 2-year period is how they calculate it. So I've seen one that's 3, but it's usually 2 years. So in effect, you're paying the benefits are coming out of your own money. You know, think of it almost like a high deductible, the policy that you've mm-hmm. purchased. So let's just say you go on claim and you start receiving benefits. They start drawing those out of your death benefit, which is another way of saying your premium. Mm-hmm. And once they've exhausted that, then the rider kicks in and continues to pay for your benefits, depending on how long you paid for in the policy, 3 years, 4 years, it just depends. Mm-hmm. So, and that's where you get the value in terms of the more dollars out for dollars in, you know, is once the insurance company's paying out of their pockets, after you've exhausted that death benefit, they're paying and you're getting that leverage. Mm-hmm. Now, what happens is if you go on long-term care, let's say you're on for 4 years and then you die, you've used up all of that death benefit. Mm-hmm. There's usually a residual benefit that is paid to your beneficiary, whoever you name on the policy. And that varies by company. It might be a minimum $5,000. It might be a certain percentage of the face amount that, you know, the money you put into the policy, but you're always going to get a little residual there. Mm-hmm. But essentially with these policies, you're either going to not use it at all and you'll get the death benefit, your beneficiary, tax-free. Or you use some or all of the benefits for long-term care, in which case your beneficiary might get something or nothing out of, in terms of the out of that death benefit. Or the third option is you surrender the policy. So if you surrender these policies, you can get back some or all of your premium that you put in. So, and it depends on the particular policy as to whether, you know, you're immediately able to get 100% back on day one, or you have to wait 10 years or 15 years to get 100% of that premium back. But they all eventually return that premium if you surrender at some amount of that premium. So keep in mind that these policies, there are three scenarios, and it's one or the other or the other. You either use up all of the life policy portion, the death benefit, for long-term care, or you don't use long-term care at all and you get the death benefit, which is equal to at least what you paid into the policy, that $100,000, or you surrender the policy and you get back most or all of your premium when you surrender it.
So this is a way, if you wanted to compare it to self-funding, which is what you're kind of signing up to do when you don't have the insurance. If you set aside thinking, well, I'll set aside some money for this. If I use it, I use it. If I don't use it, it goes to my kids. Kind of, that's the classic way of thinking. So you put aside the $100,000 and you end up not using it. The $100,000 plus any growth that happened in there, if there is any, would go to your kids. If you end up using it, it goes to zero. But once you eat up the $100,000, you have nothing more. That's the key difference here. If you put the $100,000 into one of these, like Greg was describing, in general, what's going to happen is if you don't use it, it's the death benefit's going to go to your kids, like it would have if you set the money aside. If you use it, only a portion of it, just like if you used a portion of the $100,000 you just put in an account somewhere, only the net that's left would go to your kids. It's a very similar circumstance with the insurance. But the key difference is if you burn through yourself, say you need it, you burn through the $100,000, then they keep paying you for a period of time, not necessarily forever, but for this 3, 4, 5 year period that you've contracted for, you get that. So it's not eating into your other resources, because all you did was set aside the $100,000, you're essentially saying, I'm not preparing to pay another dime past the $100,000. If you put the $100,000 into one of these types of situations, policies, you get that extension if you need it, but you get most of the benefits that you normally would have had you not used it. The big difference is the potential growth on the $100,000. What you essentially have to think about doing is the potential growth that you would see. If I'm sure there's people out there thinking, hey, if I put $100,000 aside for 20 years and I end up not using it, it's not just going to still be $100,000. It's probably going to have grown over that period. And that's what my kids would get. If they just get this $100,000 death benefit, they didn't get anything. I admit it. It's always a trade-off. It's not like there's one of these situations you can enter into that's cost-free, right? That you did something magical and you now have three times as much LTC benefit and it didn't cost you a dime. It's all about trade-offs, right? And that's the way to think about this trade-off is you don't have the liquidity or the growth potential that you would have by just setting the money aside, but you get the extension of benefits if you actually need it, but you don't give it all up because you're at least somebody, whether it's you or your beneficiaries, is going to get back what you put in. Is that a good way to kind of frame the balance?
Yeah, and I think it's another important thing to consider is the insurance company, that typically these hybrid policies will guarantee a minimum amount of growth, you know, or a little bit of cash value, mm-hmm. But it's minimal. Right. And, you know, so if rates start to go back up someday, then, you know, the insurance company is likely going to be the one to benefit from that, not you. Whereas if you, instead of taking that $100,000 and paying the insurance company for a policy, if you have that invested yourself, you know, that could be in the long run a better scenario potentially. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you're looking at these policies, the interest rate environment is a big factor in insurance, because it's, you know, it's going to affect how they price these policies, because it all comes down to how much can they earn on the premium reserves. Right. So yeah, in general, these types of policies, there are a number of other factors and advantages and disadvantages. And I know we're doing an EDU show pretty soon about these policies and a little bit more in depth. So I don't think we need to go into it now, but,
right. So this is just one of many features that you can get.
Okay. Yeah, I was just going to say the key benefit or attraction of these policies is that return of premium if you don't use it.
Right. Got it. Okay. Well, those are the slew that came in just recently on this. If you have other questions, listeners, certainly send those in. We'll do, I'm sure, another, whether we do a dedicated LTC Q&A show or we just kind of sprinkle them among the other questions that we get on a weekly basis. If you do have more LTC questions, don't hesitate to send them to us. Best way to do that would be to go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And there's a contact form on there. You can submit your questions right there. Or Jim doesn't mind if you just send the questions to him directly. So jim@jimhelps.com is always an option as well. He wanted me to be sure to mention to everyone he really appreciates the well wishes. He is doing better every week following his stroke this past November. Working too much on office-related items, in my opinion, but it's good that more stuff's getting done, but I wish, you know, if it was me, I'd probably be taking a little bit more rest, but he's a bit of a workaholic. Greg, you've are looking forward to a good weekend here. You got anything going on this weekend?
I am. It's beautiful weather. It's cold, but the sun's out, so looking forward to getting outside tomorrow.
Nice. Yeah, we've got the same thing. I'm looking out the window right now. Blue skies. It's pretty chilly right now, but here in Colorado, at least, since there's not much humidity, as long as there's sun on you, the air temperature doesn't really make you all that cold. You can go for a nice walk with a jacket on or something, as long as the sun is out. When it gets dark, it's a whole different story, but as long as you're not in the shade, it's actually quite pleasant. We don't have that you know, that bone-chilling humidity that cuts right through your coat and scarf and everything. I never knew that was a thing. I always equated humidity with uncomfortable hot weather until I was, I don't remember where it was, but someplace that was really humid and it was cold. And it was, I went out thinking, oh, it's going to be, you know, 35, 40 degrees. That's no big deal. I'm from Colorado. A little light jacket. Yeah, that was a horrible decision. The humidity.
Cleveland in November. I'll never forget one visit there. It cuts right through you.
So let me just reiterate. I hate humidity. You know, it's not just a hot thing. It's a cold thing too. I like, you know, although I will admit, when I go to a humid environment, the quality of the suppleness of my skin improves. I have grown up in this arid environment here. You don't even notice that your elbows are like leathery lizard skin, and until, you know, you spend a few days in humidity and you're like, oh my gosh, my skin is so smooth.
Right.
So I'll admit there is that one.
Yeah,
advantage.
I experienced that just being in the house versus being outside. Right. We're in the house so much during the winter and the heat's dry. So.
Cool. Well, thanks for joining me on the show today, Greg. I'm glad we got you some new, you got that new equipment. Sounds much, much better. So we'll get you on the show more frequently. Great. I'm sure we're going to have a slew, at least for the foreseeable future, some more LTC stuff come in. So we'll look forward to that EDU show where we talk about some more of the features of LTC policies. And for everybody else, thanks a lot for listening again. And we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.